This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Iran begins testing its domestically produced coronavirus vaccine on humans as the country faces difficulties in importing vaccines due to U.S. sanctions. The Palestinian Rights Group says that the Israeli regime has demolished 120 Palestinian homes in Jerusalem outputs in the year 2020. And Bangladesh sends over 1,800 Rohingya Muslim refugees to a remote island in the Bay of Bengal, despite warnings from rights groups. Welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us. Iran has begun testing its domestically produced coronavirus vaccine on humans. The testing was carried out during a ceremony where three volunteers got vaccine shots. A total of 56 volunteers will gradually receive injections during the first stage of the vaccination process. According to Iranian authorities, no symptoms such as shock or fever have been observed following the first trial inoculation. Present at the ceremony was senior researcher and member of Iran's coronavirus task force, Minu Mohraz. She said that she has high hopes that the vaccination process will go well.
I think that if the process goes well, and I'm sure that it goes well, very soon we will have our own COVID-19 vaccine, and then when we get rid of this virus, we can make vaccine for other diseases.
The senior researcher said that after all the 56 volunteers get their injections, the results will be analyzed and reported to the health ministry. If it is confirmed, she added, the next step will get underway. The Iranian COVID vaccine has been completely developed by domestic researchers. The achievement comes as the country has difficulty importing vaccines due to U.S. sanctions. University professor Mohammad Mirandi says the Iranian-made COVID vaccine shows that the country has enhanced its capabilities despite U.S. sanctions.
This is a reflection of much of the change that has taken place in Iran really after the revolution, and that Iran has moved towards becoming a power, a major power, that is also able to develop technologically. As you know better than I, whether it's stem cell research, or whether it's nanotechnology, artificial intelligence, drone technology, laser technology, nuclear technology, or sending satellites made in Iran into orbit through Iranian rockets, the Iranians have shown their ability to advance rapidly, more than any other country in this part of the world, despite the sanctions.
The Secretary of Iran's Supreme National Security Council says that the U.S. Army has increased its activities in West Asia out of fear of the consequences of Washington's past mischievous acts. Ali Shamkhani added that security and stability in West Asia will not be achieved unless American forces leave the region. A week ago, the U.S. Navy announced the arrival of a nuclear-powered submarine in the Persian Gulf, accompanied by two warships. The U.S. has increased its military presence in the region as the anniversary of the assassination of Iranian General Qasem Soleimani is approaching. Washington fears Iran might again strike U.S. forces in retaliation for Soleimani's assassination. Iran has time and again said that it does not want to initiate a conflict, but will not hesitate to defend itself in the face of any U.S. aggression. Former U.S. Army officer Scott Bennett says Zionist-controlled military-industrial complexes seek a false flag attack in the Persian Gulf to divert attention from unfolding civil war in the U.S.
I think the military-industrial complex Zionists, as they have in the past, are trying to deceive President Trump and trying to amplify and exaggerate the situation and the tensions to possibly launch some sort of a false flag attack or try and trigger a conflict in the Persian Gulf against Iran to distract people away from the unfolding civil war in the United States, which is going to begin rapidly increasing after January 6th, when President Trump exposes the Chinese Communist Party and the election meddling and the fraud and the false flag attacks that were done in the United States. That is the real tension. So any trying to draw Iran in or blame Iran for kinetic operations or say Iran's a danger, I think is a distraction away from the real wars in America.
Leader of Lebanon's Hezbollah resistance movement, Saeed Hassan Nasrallah, says that Saudi Arabia is hand in gloves with the U.S. and Israel in the assassination of Iran's top commander, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, in Iraq. Mariam Saleh reports from Beirut.
In an extensive interview, Hezbollah's Secretary General Saeed Hassan Nasrallah revealed that the criminal assassination of Iran's top commander, General Hash Qasem Soleimani, was not only an American crime, but that Israel and Saudi Arabia were culprits in this crime as well, even if their role was just to provoke Washington to commit it. The Hezbollah leader considered that it is not the responsibility only of one state or country to retaliate for that crime, but any free individual who feels that they have fidelity to those martyrs.
Trump was the main figure, but any person who took this decision or gave the order or executed the order, they all must be punished. Now it is only a matter of time. 1 month, 2 months, 1 year or 2 years, 7 years, 10 years. What the entire world needs to know is the criminals will not go unpunished. Soon or later, they will be punished. Every single free person in this nation feels they have a responsibility in punishing the culprits.
Saeed Nasrallah stressed that the decision to free the region of U.S. military presence has been taken. The leader of Lebanon's resistance spoke about the personality of General Soleimani and how he played a key role in the fight against the U.S. occupation and the fight against Takfiri terrorists.
Hash Qasem Soleimani had an instrumental role in the Arab East, especially with regards to the struggle with Israel and with the American occupation of Iraq and the American presence in the region. So it was expected that he would be targeted by the Americans. But targeting Hash Soleimani was by itself a desperate move with no horizon from the part of the Americans.
Experts believe that the cause of defeating imperialist projects continues, regardless of the loss of one major leader as an individual.
I believe that with institutions like the Revolutionary Guards, the Quds Brigade, or Hezbollah, continuity is always in the minds of the leadership who is aware of the fact that it's always targeted by the enemies.
The commander of the Quds Force of Iran's Revolutionary Guards Corps was assassinated along with his companions in a U.S. airstrike near Baghdad International Airport on January 3, 2020. Hezbollah Secretary General Saeed Hassan Nasrallah said that the crime of assassinating Hash Qasem Soleimani and Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis was orchestrated by the U.S., Israel, and Saudi Arabia, stressing that the killers will be punished. Experts believe the role of Saudi Arabia in funding assassinations goes way back in history, a role which goes against any leader who faces U.S.-Israeli agendas. Mariam Saleh, Press TV, Beirut.
1 year has passed since the U.S. assassination of top Iranian commander and resistance icon, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani. Our correspondents have talked to a number of Syrian and Palestinian people about the assassination. Let's see what they had to say.
Qasem Soleimani sacrificed his life for the sake of Palestine and spent his life fighting for Palestine. His legacy will never die because thousands more Soleimanis will be born and a new knight will lead the way.
His memory will remain forever in the hearts of Palestinians and Iranians. The assassination of Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani was especially harsh for all of us in Gaza who remain under siege. The absence of Qasem Soleimani has encouraged Arabs to normalize their relations with our enemy. His martyrdom was a great loss for Palestinians, who will find it harder to liberate their land. Since his martyrdom, Israel has stepped up its aggression and siege against the Palestinians.
Martyr Qasem Soleimani was a symbol of devotion and sacrifice for Syrian people. The services he did are unforgettable. He will remain in the memories of the coming generations in Syria. Words cannot describe his efforts and his sacrifices.
Qasem Soleimani.
May he rest in peace. He was a commander and a hero, a big hero, and a symbol of his steadfastness and sacrifice for us, especially here in Syria. I congratulate him on his martyrdom. Not all people are worthy of such martyrdom. The U.S. did not achieve anything from his assassination, because one Qasem Soleimani is gone, but 10 other Qasem Soleimanis will come. He stood alongside Syrians from Aleppo to Damascus. My brothers fought under his directives. They were ordinary fighters, but they told me he used to dine and spend time with them. He was so down to earth.
Soleimani was not the first and will not be the last resistance figure. The path of resistance and the way of Imam Hussein will live forever until liberating the last inch of every occupied land. Soleimani was a fighter, a struggler. May he rest in peace. He stood beside us. There are hundreds of others like Soleimani.
Palestinian rights group says that Israel this year has carried out 120 demolitions in Jerusalem and Al-Quds alone. The Al-Quds Center for Economic and Social Rights says that Israel has violated Palestinians' rights by razing their homes to the ground. The NGO has warned of mass demolitions in Jerusalem Al-Quds early next year. It says that Israel has issued 22,000 demolition notices for Palestinian homes and structures in the city. Israel says that it destroys the structures that lack construction permits. Palestinians project this. They say the demolitions in the occupied territories aim to expand Israeli settlements. The demolitions have been widely condemned as a violation of international law. Monica Deal on Ramallah says that Israel destroys Palestinian homes built without permits and at the same time refuses to issue construction permits for them.
Israeli municipality of Jerusalem Al-Quds claim that those homes and structures were destroyed because their owners didn't get Israeli issued permits for construction. It's something very difficult to get Israeli issued permits for people living in Jerusalem, Al-Quds, as well as in areas of the occupied West Bank, because the Israelis continue to refuse give the Palestinians these licenses in order to force them leave the area to take it. To take the land, set that next set to the Israeli settlements, or even to give these lands to the Israeli to the Israeli settlers. The Palestinian Authority, several days ago, revealed that Tel Aviv is targeting the people of Al-Quds Palestinians living there in favor of far-right Jewish settlers. It's also part of Israel's policy of intimidation, as I said, and Judaization of Al-Quds. That's why the Palestinian Authority and human rights organizations have demanded and urged international community to urgently intervene and take concrete and immediate measures in order to force Israel to stop its violations.
Bangladesh is moving a second group of Rohingya refugees to a remote island in the Bay of Bengal, despite safety objections raised by the rights groups. Officials say the process will see more than 1,800 people to be moved to Basanchar Island. More than 1,600 Rohingya refugees have already been transferred there. Bangladesh says it has made sure that the island is protected against deadly regional floods. Dhaka also says the relocations are voluntary, but Amnesty International says officials have not been transparent on safety issues. The rights groups say that some refugees have been forced to relocate. Rohingya refugees are Muslim. They were forced to flee their homeland in Myanmar in 2017, following a brutal military crackdown. The Democratic-controlled U.S. House of Representatives has voted to override President Donald Trump's veto of a $740 billion defense bill. The 322-87 vote, which enjoyed the support of more than 100 Republicans, leaves the legislation's fate to the Senate. If the Republican-led chamber seconds the House action, it would be the first veto override of Trump's presidency. Separately, the House voted overwhelmingly to increase COVID relief checks to $2,000. This bill, which meets Trump's demand for bigger payments, has now been sent to the Senate. Trump had threatened to block a $2.3 trillion pandemic aid and spending package if Congress did not boost stimulus payments. He later backed down from his threat and signed them, averting a possible government shutdown. and restoring unemployment benefits to millions of Americans. Investigative journalist Max Perry says the U.S. relief package is hugely insufficient when considering the economic devastation the pandemic has caused.
I'm going to be very surprised if this increase gets past the Senate, because it's GOP controlled, and as is the case, American lawmakers are beholden to corporations and not their constituents, and that has never been more clear than with the ineptitude of the U.S. government response to the pandemic, and the fact that so many Americans are on the verge of being evicted. Food scarcity is on the rise. You name it. So the social ills that have resulted from this combination of the pandemic and the government's mishandling is just having really severe consequences. So unfortunately, this bill, even if it does get passed, yes, it is something, but it's really not going to even put a dent in what's necessary as far as protecting the public health and securing Americans' employment and living and everything else that's necessary. And I'm not really seeing any positive signs from the incoming administration either.
Officials in the U.S. city of Columbus, Ohio, have announced the dismissal of a white police officer who fatally shot an unarmed black man last week. Columbus police chief said the evidence provided solid rationale for the officer Adam Coy's termination. The incident unfolded on Tuesday after officers responded to a non-emergency complaint about a man turning a car on and off for an extended period. Shortly after the officers arrived, the victim, identified as Andre Maurice Hill, approached them on foot with his left hand holding a cell phone. Body camera footage shows the officer shot Hill less than 10 seconds after finding him in a garage. Hill is the second African-American killed by police in less than 3 weeks in Columbus. The incident comes as anger boils in the U.S. over police brutality against African-Americans. The Venezuelan president has slammed the opposition-controlled parliament's decision not to comply with the general election results. Nicolas Maduro denounced as unconstitutional the National Assembly's move to extend its term into next year. This is while Maduro's party-led alliance won the December 6th parliamentary elections by a landslide. The opposition, however, boycotted the election, accusing the government of not adhering to free and fair votes. The accusations were echoed by the U.S. and the EU even before the election was held. Washington has introduced several rounds of sanctions on Venezuela in a bid to oust Maduro and replace him with opposition leader Juan Guaido. Jesús Silva in Caracas says that Venezuela's self-declared president Juan Guaido is losing support from both the opposition and the U.S.
There is a new opposition that participated in the legislative election. That opposition obtained a number of deputies for the parliament, and that opposition is not backing Juan Guaido. Juan Guaido is now a lonely opposition figure. He is somehow losing the support of former allies in the international community. There is doubt in the U.S. government and also in the European Union whether or not to continue proclaiming Mr. Juan Guaido as the interim president of Venezuela. So we can see that so far there is a ratification of support from some countries in North America and in Europe, but that support to Guaido is dropping down. The future is that the wing of the opposition that attended the parliamentary elections will emerge as the new opposition in Venezuela, the leading opposition in Venezuela, and they will hold debates with the ruling party in the National Assembly.
That's all the time we have for this edition of World News. So bye-bye for now.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood qudde saratani Israel mukhalifim.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is part of a speech of Ayatollah Khamenei delivered on January 8, 2020, in a meeting with the people of the city of Qom. The meeting was held on the anniversary of an uprising led by the people of the city of Qom on January 9, 1978.
Allah the Exalted has reiterated throughout the Quran that people should not forget what has happened to previous ummas. They were covered with humiliation and misery. They drew on themselves the wrath of Allah. The Holy Quran, chapter 2, verse 61. This is just one of the ayahs in this regard, but there are many others where Moses said to Bani Israel, O my people, did not your Lord make a beautiful promise to you? Did then the promise seem to you long in coming? The Holy Quran, chapter 20, verse 86. Until some time ago, you were under the pressure of the Pharaoh. Did the incident occur a long time ago that you have forgotten it? You say, O Moses, fashion for us a god like the gods they have. The Holy Quran, chapter 7, verse 138. These are lessons. These are points that I have always repeated. Today, pious, committed, and enthusiastic youth are better than compared to the beginning of the revolution in terms of quantity and quality. This is the case today. We are not dissatisfied, but you should take care to tread the right path. There is a great lesson presented to us by the Quran, the Holy Prophet, and God. Allah suffices for anyone who trusts Him. The Holy Quran, chapter 8, verse 49. We should not forget this lesson, and we should always keep it in mind.
Your light and love, all I see, nothing more I'd ever want to need. My Lord, protect me from dishonor, grant me faith to be stronger.
Now I wish to raise 2-3 points about our dear martyr, Haj Qasem Soleimani. One point is about his character. Well, these days, many things have been said about that great personality, that good, dear, courageous, and fortunate comrade of ours who went to heaven. And what they said about him and his personality traits are correct. But I too wish to raise certain points which I think are important. Shahid Soleimani was both brave and insightful. His actions were not merely marked by courage. Some people have courage, but they do not have the necessary wisdom and acumen to utilize their courage. And some people enjoy wisdom, but they do not take action. They do not have the guts to take action. Our dear martyr both had the necessary guts and the necessary acumen.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah. Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah.
The U.S. is facing another crisis thanks to the actions of the U.S. President Donald Trump. This time, it has to deal with a massive COVID-19 relief bill. Donald Trump said that he is unhappy with the massive bill, which provides $892 billion in coronavirus relief, including extending special unemployment benefits. $1.4 trillion is also needed for normal government spending. The U.S. president said that he is not signing it, in part because that one-off $600 stimulus checks for struggling Americans are not large enough.
I am asking Congress to amend this bill and increase the ridiculously low $600 to $2,000 or $4,000 for a couple.
An increase to the size of the checks was something Democrats attempted to get, but Republicans refused to accept it, throwing it further into doubt the future of any imminent financial relief for millions of struggling Americans. However, the U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi plans to hold a vote to approve the $2,000 checks on Monday. Another objection made by Trump was that the bill gives too much money to special interests, cultural projects, and foreign aid.
$600 for the past several months that Americans haven't received any assistance is almost nothing. It's $1.75 a day. It's quite pathetic, especially when you look at how the rest of the bill gives millions of dollars. It gives $33 million to Juan Guaido. It gives millions of dollars to Israel to regime change measures. And this $600 essentially is going to go to landlords. It's going to go to banks. Americans are going to see that money, and it will be gone in the next moment.
Trump's refusal to sign the bill is not just affecting jobless benefits. A partial government shutdown will begin on Tuesday, unless Congress can agree a stopgap government funding bill before then. The U.S. president's move surprised many, particularly since Trump left nearly all of the negotiations to Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin, who made no push for the $2,000 stimulus checks that the U.S. president is now seeking. All through the months-long wrangling between Democrats and Republicans over the stimulus package, Trump did not say anything. He didn't object to the terms of the deal before Congress voted it through on Monday. But since then, Trump has constantly complained about it. If he continues to refuse to sign the bill, more than 14 million laid-off Americans could lose their unemployment benefits for weeks. Even if Trump finally agrees to sign it, they would likely suffer a break in payments. States cannot pay out benefits for weeks that begin before the bill is signed. Now, as a result of Trump's refusal to sign the bill, benefits will not restart until the first week of January, but they will still end in mid-March, effectively trimming the extension to 10 weeks from 11. Moreover, a series of additional relief provisions, including an eviction moratorium, are set to expire at the end of the month. Other temporary relief protections shielding millions of Americans from the brunt of the pandemic's economic toll will lapse shortly after the new year without action. Top officials, including Pelosi and Mnuchin, are now privately discussing plans such as a stopgap spending bill in case Trump formally vetoes the measures by Monday. But it is not clear how long that stopgap measure would last or whether Trump would sign it if it makes none of the changes that he wanted. Trump never said that he would veto the legislation anyway. However, he may not have to. The legislation passed with the support of, well, more than two-thirds of both the House and the Senate, easily surpassing the threshold required to override a veto if he actually did that.
It appears to be a partisan divide. Now Trump is saying he won't sign the stimulus package because it's too low. But we also have to look at the fact that when this bill was signed, it was signed with a supermajority in both houses, in both the House of Representatives and in the Senate. And we gotta also remember that the Democrats now have the majority in the House of Representatives. So because they had two-thirds in both the House of Representatives and the Senate, it really doesn't matter if Trump refuses to sign it or not. Of course, the Congress would hope that Trump signs it and that they can get it done, but they could still veto his veto.
But in this scenario, timing means everything. A legislation can become law 10 days after the bill is enrolled, even without a presidential signature. But because the time frame overlaps with the end of the current Congress in January the 3rd and the convening of the 117th Congress, some called a pocket veto can become a possibility. A pocket veto is a legislative maneuver that allows the U.S. president or another official with veto power to exercise that power over a bill by taking no action instead of affirmatively vetoing it. If that happens, all legislation dies with Congress. So without Trump's signature in the next 10 days, the bill would have to be reintroduced and voted on a second time. This means more delay in funding of the government and providing relief to struggling Americans and businesses.
Yemen is currently the world's worst humanitarian catastrophe. Yemeni people are facing a long list of unbearable problems such as daily airstrikes, famine-like conditions, different deadly diseases, and an economy in tatters. Meanwhile, Yemeni children are undoubtedly the most vulnerable part of the population. The situation of children in Yemen has been described as a crisis within a broader humanitarian catastrophe. This week, Yemen's health minister once again raised the alarm about the situation of children in his country. Taha al-Mutawakkili said 3,800 children have been killed in attacks carried out by the Saudis and their allies over the past years. He also warned that the aggressors' bombardment campaign has devastated Yemen's health infrastructure, making it increasingly difficult to save children. The plight of the Yemeni kids has once again come under the spotlight just a few months before the 6th anniversary of the beginning of the Saudi-led military offensive against Yemen. Earlier this month, the United Nations Children's Fund said one Yemeni child dies every 10 minutes from a preventable disease, 2 million are out of school, and thousands have been killed or maimed since 2015. The United Nations has been quite loud in voicing concern about the ongoing crisis, but it is also under fire for removing the Saudi-led coalition this year from a blacklist of child killers. The Saudi-led alliance was first blacklisted several years ago for killing and injuring children in the war.
The United Nations, of course, has this very typical, very endemic weakness, I dare say, being that it's an organization that for a big part is dependent on the world superpowers to really take action. And we have seen in the past that for this reason, it is very difficult sometimes for the United Nations to really come into action, even when a lot of the member states might want to. We have enormous pressure from Saudi Arabia.
It was on March 25, 2015, when Saudi Arabia and its allies, such as the United Arab Emirates, began pounding Yemen from air, sea, and ground. Now, another anniversary of the beginning of the offensive is drawing close with no end in sight to the campaign. Why is this war dragging on so long, and why is the international community failing to put an end to it? The invaders launched a bloody offensive in the hope of achieving a quick victory. However, to this day, none of the stated goals of the military campaign have been met, with the Saudi-led onslaught being described as a fiasco. But the invaders are not changing course. They have indiscriminately bombarded civilian areas. Markets, funerals, weddings, jails, medical and water supply facilities have all been hit. This has taken a heavy toll on Yemen's infrastructure and civilian population. Western countries, particularly the United States and Britain, have refused to review their ties with Saudi Arabia over the bloodshed in Yemen. They have instead intensified their backing of Al Saud. The United States and Britain have stepped up their arms sales to the regime despite the human suffering in Yemen. Meanwhile, the United States has provided the Saudi and Emirati forces with different types of military assistance. Critics insist the heavy U.S. military support has made America a partner to the devastating war. Observers believe without Western diplomatic and military support, the onslaught would have ended a very long time ago.
The sworn enemy of the Iran nuclear deal will be leaving office very soon. The U.S. President Donald Trump, who unilaterally withdrew America from the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action in May 2018, left no stones unturned to completely destroy the JCPOA. Trump managed to significantly undermine the hard-earned international deal, but he failed to achieve his ultimate goal of killing the deal. Now, just weeks before Trump becomes a former U.S. president, the remaining signatories to the nuclear deal renewed their commitment this week to preserve it. The foreign ministers of Iran, China, Russia, Germany, France, and the United Kingdom agreed on Monday that no party should set fresh preconditions on a revival of the JCPOA. Their statement is believed to be paving the way for Washington and Tehran to come back into full compliance when Joe Biden takes office in January. Trump tried to destroy the deal by imposing tough sanctions and scaring off other countries from doing business with Iran. In response, Tehran has rolled back some of its JCPOA commitments. The next U.S. president will need to remove Trump's favorite sanctions against Iran, and Tehran, in return, will be expected to put back in place certain limitations on its nuclear program based on the JCPOA.
But if they return to the nuclear deal and into full compliance in action, Tehran will do the same by returning practically into full compliance. What is important here is that that return by the U.S. or some other parties to the nuclear deal into compliance, if it happens, theoretically, that will not suffice. What they need to do is that they return practically and in action.
The U.S. President-elect has pledged to restore the JCPOA when he takes office. Will America take this opportunity to rejoin international diplomacy and multilateralism? The running Foreign Minister, Mohammad Javad Zarif, has repeatedly said that American sanctions deprived Iran of the benefits that his country is entitled to under the nuclear deal. Iran's top diplomat says the Europeans share the blame of the irreparable economic harm to Iranians. On Monday, Zarif took to Twitter after the meeting with his counterparts from China, Russia, Germany, France, and the UK. He posted a chart showing how trade between Iran and the EU has gone down over the past years, despite repeated European promises of better economic ties under the JCPOA. Zarif warned that this is a last chance for the Europeans to save the deal. The top diplomat said that Tehran will quickly reverse the measures that it took in response to the U.S. withdrawal and European breaches if they perform their duties well. Iranians are undoubtedly infuriated by the West's failure or unwillingness to properly implement the deal. Recently, Iran's parliament passed a piece of legislation that would prevent UN inspections of Iranian nuclear sites if sanctions are not eased within 2 weeks after Biden takes office. The new law would also require the administration to enrich uranium to the 20% level using advanced centrifuges. Some senior European diplomats, like the UK Foreign Secretary Dominic Raab, said that Iran should not further dilute its nuclear commitments. Some observers believe, however, that instead of lecturing Iran, the EU should immediately focus on how it can properly fulfill its own commitments.
I think the one side that can have demands is Iran, because after the withdrawal of the United States from the nuclear deal, that was Tehran who remained in the deal. Iran showed strategic patience for a year, and after that 1 year, Iran's reduction of commitments happened under the terms of the nuclear deal. So they have done the violation, and the Europeans were, despite their words and promises, were unable to compensate the U.S. withdrawal and exit from the nuclear deal.
Time is fast running out. Iran's top diplomat insists that no democratic country should expect the government to violate the deadlines set by the recently approved parliamentary legislation.
It seems that the incumbent U.S. President Donald Trump is keen to leave his mark on the presidency by pardoning some of the most horrific state crimes, with yet more anger raised by his most recent action. In his latest moment of absolution, Trump has officially given a pardon to the private security mercenaries from the so-called Blackwater security firm, a U.S. company shrouded in controversy and shame over crimes committed by its personnel in Iraq. During the incident in Iraq in 2007, four Blackwater security personnel opened fire, threw grenades, and used high-caliber weapons against a crowd of Iraqi civilians, killing 14 innocent, unarmed people, two of which were children. Following an investigation by parties including the FBI, the four guilty Blackwater murderers were sentenced to jail terms ranging from 30 years to life, something that many believe was too lenient, yet others thought were too harsh.
أتمنى من المحكمة الأمريكية بعد ما توصلت إلى هذا القرار القرار الإدانة أن تصدر قرارها بإعدام الجنات لأن هناك ما يقارب 20 عراقي أو 19 عراقي راحوا ضحية.
In spite of the crimes committed by the four men, many people in the U.S. fought to seek a pardon for them long prior to Trump announcing the plan, with the lawyer representing the criminals, Brian Heberlig, suggesting that the four did not deserve to spend 1 minute in prison for their crimes. One can only then question the rationale behind the reasoning of both Trump and the lawyer of the four murderers, especially when it comes to allowing such acts to happen, only for the powers that be allow for the criminals to get away with a crime and the ending
of 14 innocent lives. There's a famous song that states that you can get by with a little help from your friends, and it seems that this is very much the case for the friends and partners of Donald Trump. Already Trump has pardoned some highly questionable figures in recent times, with many of them coming from the military or private sector background that enjoy close links to the president. Most recently, Trump has also pardoned Paul Manafort, Roger Stone and Charles Kushner, all close contacts and all sentenced for corruption and lies.
Thank you, Mr. President. Thank you for giving me the offer. Thank you for saving my life, because I don't think at my age and in my medical condition I would have survived in a COVID-infested prison. The president has said on numerous occasions that he thought there was a good chance I could be exonerated. I agree with that.
But it's Trump's links to Blackwater that raises questions, with Eric Prince, the founder of the company, not only being a close ally of Trump, but has also acted as an official representative of the president in the past, something that clearly shows that there's a link between the pardon and the two close friends. Yet the pardon also comes as no surprise, as in reality, the victims of the terrible crimes committed have all been in US-occupied lands, suggesting that Trump is continuing his discriminatory policy against non-white people, something that Trump has certainly become renowned for over the years. But for Trump, there's no doubt that his famous motto of Make America Great Again has failed, and after 4 years in the White House and his seemingly effortless ability to divide the nation at home and create tension abroad, Trump's true lasting legacy will be MARA, or in its full form, Make America Racist Again, the one impact that Trump has been able to deliver on, it seems.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are and wherever you are listening to us.
The keys of life.
Axel Djawadi talks about the various keys of life and has brought about this book to be a companion for the very famous Mafatih al-Jinan, where one is a tool or the keys for paradise, and this book, of course, are the keys of life.
The Keys of Life, a program designed to tell you that what Islam gives you will help get you home with joy and faithfulness. So, well, listen to
the keys of life.
The world is a very, very big house, many people living in many rooms. We must open all the doors up, we must unlock them all today. Throw all the keys away.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. My name is Sheikh Zayed Al-Salami. A few years ago, I started the course of wanting to commentate on a very important book that I believe is something that would be useful for everyone who reads it, and that is the book Mafatih al-Hayat, written by Ayatollah al-Uzma al-Sheikh Jawadi Amuli. You know, what Islam emphasizes on in you acquiring, you gaining that level of rizq, that level of, you know, sustenance, and at the same time you working for it. Imam Ali Rida salamullahi alayhi, in a hadith, he says from Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa alihi, he says in a hadith Qudsi let me read the hadith for you. قال الله تعالى في ليلة المعراج يا أحمد. Sorry, I don't know. This hadith wasn't from Imam Rida, the one that before that, which is a person who works to gain sustenance for his family, is greater in the eyes of Allah than a mujahid fi sabilillah. Anyway, the next hadith, the fifth hadith on this page of chapter 3, is the hadith, which is a hadith Qudsi, where it says, قَالَ اللَّهُ تَعَالَى فِي لَيْلَةِ الْمِعْرَاجِ يَا أَحْمَدُ أو أحمد إِنَّ الْعِبَادَةَ عَشْرَةُ أَجْزَاءٍ. The ibadah is made up of 10 parts. سَبْعَةٌ مِّنْهَا طَلَبُ الْحَلَالِ. 7 of them are seeking halal means, seeking halal income. فَإِنْ أُطِيبَ مَطَعَمُكَ وَمَشْرَبُكَ. So, if your food and your drinking becomes طيب, طيب here in the sense of it being halal, it being legitimate, the money that you are acquiring, the sustenance that you are acquiring, your livelihood is based on something that is purely halal. فَإِنْ أُطِيبَ مَطَعَمُكَ وَمَشْرَبُكَ فَأَنْتَ فِي حِفْظِي وَكَنَفِي. You are going to be within my thoughts of protection and assistance and shelter. فَأَنْتَ فِي حِفْظِي وَكَنَفِي. What a beautiful hadith. Which means that should we work, should we seek an income, and that income be halal, then we are going to live within the protection and shelter of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And that's why when we're looking at it in this particular way, it's not an issue of how much more money you are able to gain and working more than what you are physically able to or mentally able to is also something that has been censured by our religion Islam. And there's a beautiful hadith that I would like to share with you.
Ayatollah Jawadi Amuli, the author of the book Mafatih al-Hayat, The Keys of Life. This book, Mafatih, ought to be in two volumes.
یه جلدش هی مفاتی الجنان است چه فرون دماغ و سواب داره فرون رو دون
One volume, the present volume, مفاتیح الجنان, is on the level of the lofty rewards for praying, fasting, etc.
یه جلدش کم داره و اینه که فرون درخت کاری رو کم سواب داره دعا هم داره سواب هم داره
But the book lacks its second volume, which ought to be on subjects like the lofty rewards for planting a tree. Imam has mentioned both of these subjects. The very Imam who has stressed out the reward for praying, has also highlighted the reward for planting a tree. There are generous amounts of reward for protecting the environment. When growing wheat, take some in your hand and say these prayers. These are what the very Imam has mentioned. We lack this second volume in the Islamic world.
So we have two sides of ifrat and tafriat, of extremism here. We've got one side where a person is kasul, lazy, you know, and that's the worst of characteristics that a person can have, you know. And the other side of the extreme is being a workaholic, is someone who works on hours and hours on end, you know, and doesn't give enough time for their own physical body or their mind to rest, and doesn't give time for any of the other things that they need to do, whether they be social activities, family-related matters, and anything else, you know, that needs to come along with that. So you work so much so that you are able to live a comfortable life in the sense that, you know, you are doing something for yourself. You know, you're getting somewhere in life. You know, and this beautiful hadith says that من بات ساهرا في كسب ولم يعط العين. So this hadith, it says that someone who stays up late in working, في كسب, in trying to gain a sustenance, ولم يعط العين حظها من النوم, and has not given their eyes enough adequate resting and sleeping, فَكَسْبُهُ ذَٰلِكَ حَرَامٌ, that work that they did is haram, is forbidden. Of course, you know, Ayatollah Jawadi Amuli here also says between brackets, it doesn't mean that the income that they acquired from this excessive work is haram, no. But that form of working or overworking, overloading yourself and working so much so that you are not giving your limbs, the parts of your body, enough rest, you know, that means you are going into the stage of a kind of excessiveness, a kind of extremism where you become a workaholic, and of course that's going to be detrimental not only to your health but also to your social life. So when we talk about having no himma at all, having no determination, being a kasul person, a lazy person, you know, that is, you know, as one hadith says, it's a source of haqara. It's a source of a person becoming degenerate, you know, where all they do, everything that is around them is nothing other than having no form of interest in doing anything. On the same time, you know, a person who overworks and things like that is also something not good. And we'll continue on with chapter number 4 in our next episode. Walhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. Wa salatu wa salamu ala Sayyidina Muhammad wa alihi tahirin.
Driving past, walking fast to the field of dreams. Hear the children scream.
There was The Keys of Life by Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran, IRIB English Radio.
Every corner represents a different image in my mind. A momentary emotion, space spent in time. Memories fade like a dusty window pane. And you can't see your past no more. The only thing that remains is that feeling of warmth in your heart that will